Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Tuesday, July 12th. What will today's January 6th hearing bring? To my mind, a very important exercise in connecting the violent dots to Trump as directly as they can without stretching the facts further than they'll go, and an explanation of how organized some of the violent right-wing extremist groups in this country were and are, that is, how much of an ongoing threat they pose to safety and democracy. An article on Time Magazine's site today about armed groups like these since January 6th is very interesting and chilling, really, and I want to read you a paragraph. It says, over the last year and a half, the groups have surfaced at protests against COVID-19 vaccines and other government public health measures at state capitals. They've disrupted school board and town council meetings to protest mask mandates. Recently, these groups have been more visible in public. On June 9th, the same week the January 6th committee held its first public hearing, a Proud Boys group stormed a, quote, drag queen story hour event at a local library in California, shouting slurs and, you're not safe here. Over the July 4th weekend, a group of men wearing Proud Boys emblems gathered at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, while about 100 people associated with white supremacist Patriot Front group marched through Boston carrying shields and flags with their insignia. Anti-government militias and extremist groups like the Proud Boys have appeared at 27 abortion-related events as of July 1st, according to new data shared with Time by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, a nonprofit that tracks political violence. That amounts to a 160% spike over the previous year. So all of that from Time Magazine today. So these groups are growing, not shrinking, after the insurrection they staged. And the key question for me today will be if the committee can actually connect Trump to the plan of some of these groups to break in and physically obstruct the transfer of power, or if Trump will still have a cloak of plausible deniability intact, because tweeting will be wild doesn't mean go and bear spray Capitol Police officers and doesn't mean actually try to hang Mike Pence and things like that. It could be taken to mean go make a lot of noise while the Trump allies in Congress try to reject the electors and make the states recertify. So we will start there with Roger Parloff, senior editor at Lawfare. The site describes itself as being about hard national security choices. He is also an attorney, and he previously spent 12 years as the main legal affairs correspondent for Fortune magazine. He's also closely following the Steve Bannon subplot that's been unfolding the last few days. Roger, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
And let's start with Bannon, because I think he's your most intense obsession of the moment. And his offer to testify before the committee, after all, after defying their subpoenas and getting charged with criminal contempt, I see at least two theories here as to what he's up to. Either he's just caving to the justice system to try to get out of his contempt of Congress potential prison sentence, or he and Trump are cooking up a hostile witness counter-narrative appearance, which the committee hasn't had one of yet. They haven't had to deal with that. Do you think it's one or the other, or maybe even both?
I think certainly if he testifies, it might help him in terms of sentencing on the criminal contempt charge, assuming he's convicted and he's running out of defenses. But we don't know what he has to say and whether that would actually help Trump in the long run. Certainly, you know, if he's thinking of having a live interview, that's not going to happen. I think that would be ideal for his purposes. Obviously, Trump would love a counter narrative, but the committee's not going to let that happen. Also, he's going to have to produce documents first before he is deposed. That's how they always do it. It's not 100% clear he's willing to do that. His lawyer has said he is. So it's going to take a little while, but I don't think he's going to get his live moment on TV.
And if Bannon's motive was to wriggle out of his contempt of Congress criminal charge, a court proceeding yesterday made that look like a spectacular failure. I know you've been following this closely. What happened with Steve Bannon in court yesterday?
He lost almost every motion that he had filed, and he had filed a ton of them. There's a lot of money being poured into this case. He comes out of it. He did not get the postponement that he wanted. He wanted to postpone till October. He also did not get the right to present the defenses he wanted to present. He did not, you know, he had subpoenaed, he issued a trial subpoena to 16 people, Congress members and staff members, but Pelosi and all the members of the January 6th committee, you know, really trying to produce sort of a circus. The judge rejected all of that. And I would say, incidentally, the judge is a Trump appointee and a Clarence Thomas clerk. And he really poured Bannon out yesterday.
How do you think the day in court yesterday will affect Bannon's proclaimed willingness to testify?
I do think it should begin thinking about how to mitigate the sentence here if he is convicted. It's a misdemeanor, but it's two misdemeanors. It's two counts because there was the document subpoena and the deposition subpoena. So it's 1 year each. And so it's 2 years. And there's actually a minimum a sentence of 30 days. So maybe he's taking it more seriously. And of course, you know, he did testify against Roger Stone a few years ago. Roger Stone's still bitter about that. So it's conceivable he could testify. And that would really be interesting because we really don't know what was happening at the Willard that day. So if he comes clean, that'll be interesting.
Remind everybody of what that reference is, the Willard.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, there was this so-called war room at the Willard Hotel January 5th, where Bannon and Giuliani and Boris Epstein and Bernard Kerik were all, and Eastman were all there. And nobody really knows what was happening. And in fact, I guess we heard from Cassidy Hutchinson on June 28th, the last hearing, that Mark Meadows actually had thoughts of going over there on the evening of January 5th. And Cassidy Hutchinson prevailed upon him not to do that. But apparently he did contact them by phone. So it's very interesting. And Bannon, of course, on his podcast on the night of January 5th, gave this very provocative prediction that all hell was going to break loose the next day.
In fact, I have that clip. Why don't I play that right now? Yeah. This is Bannon on his radio show, as Roger was just saying, January 5th, the day before the riot, of course, reinforcing Trump's earlier tweet to come to D.C. that day because it, quote, will be wild.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. Just understand this. All hell is going to break loose tomorrow.
So, Roger, do you think the committee might replay that clip today in trying to establish Trump's personal responsibility for the violence?
It's quite possible. I just don't know what their exact agenda is. I just don't know.
Well, I laid out in the intro a question I have going into today. Can the committee actually connect Trump to the plan of some of these groups to break in and physically obstruct the transfer of power? Or if Trump will still have a cloak of plausible deniability intact because tweeting will be wild doesn't mean go and bear spray Capitol Police officers, doesn't mean actually try to hang Mike Pence for real and things like that. Do you have any knowledge of how closely they'll be able to connect those dots or if that's even the goal?
I'm sure it I'm sure it's a goal. I don't have knowledge of what's coming, but you know, Jamie Raskin, who's co-leading this session, the congressman, was the lead impeachment manager at the second impeachment, where the charge was inciting insurrection. So this is something he's really been focused on for years, and he's a constitutional law professor. So I think what we'll certainly see is a lot of cues and signals and dog whistles, which are well known, but hopefully we will see some more. The biggest dog whistle is the one you mentioned, the tweet of December 19th, "Be there, we'll be wild." And I think what we'll probably see is how that was received in the extremist sphere. And it was immediately, we know it was immediately received powerfully. It was reposted minutes later to a site called the Donald.win, which had some really fanatical and violent supporters, and where it was regarded as a signal for revolt. Somebody said something like, "He can't exactly tell you to revolt. This is the closest he'll get." And then a few hours later, you know, Alex Jones of InfoWars, who I think we'll be hearing about probably today, he called it one of the most historic events in American history. And then Kelly Meggs of the Oath Keepers, one of the important Florida leaders of the Oath Keepers, he reacts and says, "He wants us to make it wild. That's what he's saying." And then the day after this tweet, the then head of the Proud Boys, the chairman, Enrique Tarrio, creates something called a new chapter called the Ministry of Self-Defense. And mm-hmm. that goes on to play a huge role in the January 6th insurrection.
But in Trump's defense, to play devil's advocate here, just because these groups that are inclined to violence interpreted Will Be Wild as the closest he could come to, say, go and commit acts of violence and break into the Capitol, doesn't necessarily add up to criminal liability for Trump. In fact, let me play a clip of Trump on January 6th that we hear a lot on Fox News that is exculpatory for him.
"We have come to demand that Congress do the right thing and only count the electors who have been lawfully slated. I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Today we will see whether Republicans stand strong for integrity of our elections."
So obviously he's lying about who the duly elected electors were and integrity of the elections, but he said march peacefully and patriotically. How much does that get him off the hook?
Well, that's a terrific question. That's the key question. That's a 75-minute speech, and that line, which only occurs once, occurs very early in it. And then there's lots of fight like hell, you've got to fight to take your country back. There's lots of provocative language. There's lots of provocative language about Pence, particularly that he's not doing the right thing. And now we know that throughout this whole thing, he knew that the crowd was quite armed. He had already been advised of the magnetometers and wanted to get rid of them. And so he's talking to an armed mob, and he wants to lead them to the Capitol. So I think we're beginning to get further and further to crossing over the hurdle presented by the First Amendment, especially if you don't look. It's not one speech. It's a course of conduct over months, and this drumbeat of lies about the election, and with everyone telling him these are false, and nothing will stop him. So I that would be part of the case. I think another thing we might listen for was, Cassidy Hutchinson also mentioned that she believed that Meadows had called on the night of January 15th. And she said she thought he had completed a call with Roger Stone and General Flynn.
Sorry, you broke up a second. January what?
I'm sorry, on the evening of January 5th.
Thank you.
Am I coming through okay?
Yes, you're fine.
Okay. On the evening of January 5th, Meadows, she thought he had completed a call with Roger Stone and General Flynn, former retired Lieutenant General Flynn, Michael Flynn. And so we might be hearing, I'll be interested to see if we're hearing more about that today. Roger Stone, of course, has very close ties with both groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. And of course, he was being protected that day, that both the 5th and the 6th, by about six Oath Keepers, most of whom later breached the Capitol.
By the way, before we probably leave Steve Bannon aside for the rest of this conversation, unless callers want to bring him back into it, which is fine, but what would you want to ask Steve Bannon if he testified before the committee?
I would want to know what was happening in that room at the Willard. Because we really don't know. And also what he had in mind when he predicted that all hell was going to break loose. What were his sources of information? He's got a lot to tell us. You know, there's a curious thing I haven't really heard. This is just me. I haven't really heard anyone concentrating on it, but why is everybody in the Willard that night? I mean, usually all of these people were in Trump's own hotel, you know, currying favor and giving him, in effect, money and emoluments. And this night, why is this night different from all other nights? This night, they're all at the Willard. And Roger Stone is there in a different room. And they're all distancing Trump from this. You know, it seems that there's some sense that maybe tonight they shouldn't be operating out of the Trump. That's just me, but I'm maybe that's conspiratorial.
No, that's an interesting thread to try to follow. Milton in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Milton.
Hi.
Hi there. We gotcha.
I'm curious to know your opinion of the use of the presidential seal, which kind of screams out every time we see vigils or that speech, and wonder how much planning went into making a decision to deploy that seal to the rally site. It didn't get there by itself. Some degree of planning must have been involved, and that seal, with Trump standing behind it, was, in my opinion, weaponized and then brandished to the crowd and was an element of the incitement.
And I guess to confer legitimacy as if it was an act of the government, I actually don't know this detail, Roger. Is the premise here correct that when Trump was giving his January 6th rally speech, he had the seal of the President of the United States in front of him on the podium?
You know, I hadn't noticed that either. If it's true, it's interesting. Obviously, this was more in the nature of a campaign speech, but he wasn't one to be very careful about those Hatch Act distinctions.
Hatch Act being the federal law that's supposed to keep you separating your campaign activities from your elected office activities.
Exactly, yeah. But it's an interesting point. I'm afraid I hadn't zeroed in on that.
Let me play another clip of Cassidy Hutchinson, top aide to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows on January 6th, whose testimony was so dramatic last time. Of course, she was just 24 at the time and a real, you know, Republican up-and-comer. She had worked for Ted Cruz and then worked in the Trump White House with Mark Meadows until she was on hand for all of that, even though it apparently alienated her. She refers here to another person who I think we're going to hear from today on tape, and that is White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Listen.
Mr. Cipollone said something to the effect of, please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. Keep in touch with me. We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable.
Hello?
If we make that movement happen.
And do you remember which crimes Mr. Cipollone was concerned with?
In the days leading up to the 6th, we had conversations about potentially obstructing justice or defrauding the electoral count.
Possible criminal activity. I don't know if you were able to hear the clip, Roger. Cassidy Hutchinson invoking White House counsel Pat Cipollone's concern that they could get charged with a lot of crimes for what they were doing or about to do on January 6th. And Cipollone, a little bit like Bannon maybe, but different, agreed to finally sit down with the committee, and that happened behind closed doors on Friday. I think we're anticipating seeing some video clips of that this afternoon. How would you potentially connect the dots between Cassidy Hutchinson's moment there and what we might see from Cipollone's own lips today?
I would love to hear that from his lips. I think there's been some reporting that he wasn't asked that question, and that he has said he doesn't recall that particular comment. So we might not hear him verifying that testimony. But they do apparently plan to use some clips from him, and they have teased that there will be maybe some new stuff. And what she said about, apparently he had, what she said was that he had warned him a number of times. He had warned him, he had tried to get Trump to take out the language about Pence from his speech, and that failed. He had tried to get him to take out the fight like hell language, and that failed. And then he had tried to persuade him not to go to the Capitol. And of course, he tried very desperately. We don't know if there was a physical altercation, but he certainly tried very desperately to go where he had no constitutional function and where his appearance would obviously further incite what he knew to be an armed mob. So, yeah, we would love to hear from Pat Cipollone about these things.
I wonder how much they'll emphasize today Trump's lack of intervention once the break-in began as evidence of his complicity with it. For example, here's a clip they played last time of CBS News anchor Nora O'Donnell on the afternoon of January 6th, while this was going on, interviewing House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy.
I want to quickly bring in Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader. Leader McCarthy, do you condemn this violence?
I completely condemn the violence in the Capitol. What we're currently watching unfold is un-American. I am disappointed. I'm sad. This is not what our country should look like. This is not who we are. This is not the First Amendment. This has to stop, and this has to stop now.
Leader McCarthy, the President of the United States has a briefing room steps from the Oval Office. It is, the cameras are hot 24/7, as you know. Why hasn't he walked down and said that now?
I conveyed to the president what I think is best to do, and I'm hopeful the president will do it.
So there was that. And we heard about Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and Don Jr. and others who were, of course, all in with Trump in general, urging him to say and do more for the sake of their own side's own political future, never mind right and wrong. Is there more to establish on that storyline that we could hear today?
Well, that's possible. That was already pretty powerful testimony. I think the way I look at it is that is evidence of his state of mind during that speech and before. I don't think it's a separate crime not his inaction once this happens, but I think it's evidence of his state of mind when he delivered that speech, that he really did want this result, and he's showing that he's sort of ratifying, he's showing that this was his intent.
Roger Parloff, senior editor at Lawfare, the site that describes itself as being about hard national security choices. He's also an attorney, and he previously spent 12 years as the main legal affairs correspondent for Fortune magazine. Certainly, I know your Twitter this afternoon will be all over the hearing as it proceeds, and we will have live coverage this afternoon at 1 o'clock here on WNYC. Roger, thanks so much for coming on with us. Good discussion. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.